Welcome to Work in Progress, an AGGV podcast.
This episode focuses on the exhibition Symbiosis. Myself, Jamie Isaac, and Mel Granley, co-curators, will speak with a sample selection of participating artists from the show and explore resonant themes between works and ideas around fungi and forest ecologies. The exhibition Symbiosis examines all things mycenaeal and boreal, with emphasis on climate action, indigenous perspectives and knowledge, pop culture, and multi-species futurities. We will delve into conversation with artists Diane Brissado, Sarah Jim, and Randy Cook, speaking about their works in the exhibition as well as their artistic practices at large. Relationality is a central tenet within Symbiosis, as the exhibition contemplates the relationship between mycelium, tree systems, and how all things prosper when our forests are in good health. Through this podcast, the curators aim to expand upon the relationships forged between the artists and themselves, in keeping with the idea of good relations.
Tanche Kiowau Mel Dishinikashun, Oschenia Maka Amiskusakin, Mia Limichif, Monfemi, Shalafu Paquette, Roland Blake P. Granley. Hello, everybody. My name is Mel Granley. I am Métis and I come from the Edmonton area. My family names are Paquette, Shalafu, Roland, Blake, and Granley. So I am Métis on my mom's side from Treaty 6 territory, mostly from Edmonton or Amiskwasakin. On my dad's side, I'm a fourth generation Ukrainian settler. So his great-grandparents came over like several generations back and settled in southern Alberta. I've been living on Lekwungen lands as a visitor for 10 years. I moved out here to do my undergrad, and after graduation, I've been lucky to work in gallery settings and work in curatorial roles for the last few years. And so I'm here today as the co-curator of Symbiosis. I have always been a big fan of mushrooms, and I have wanted to curate an exhibition about mushrooms and trees for, I think, like 4 years. And yeah, it's been kind of a dream come true to be able to curate this exhibition with Jamie.
That's a beautiful introduction, Mel. Buzu, Anin, Nishnikaz, Jamie Isaac, Sagin, Donji, Magwa, Dodem. I am Jamie Isaac. I am a member of Sagin First Nation, Anishinaabe Ikwe, from Treaty 1 Territory. And I come from a beautiful matriarch of women from Sagin. And on my father's side, I am second generation settler from Britain, mixed European. So I come from a curatorial and artistic background, and I am the former chief curator at the Art Gallery of Greater Victoria and co-curator of Symbiosis exhibition, which I'm feel really honored to be working with Mel, and we certainly had a lot of fun curating this show together and our combined love of the wonderful and mysterious world of fungi and trees has been, I think, a major gift just in terms of having the time to research what we love and to delve a little bit deeper. Really also so honored and privileged to work with all of the artists in Symbiosis and exploring these worlds through different media and concepts and philosophies. So today with this episode, we are really lucky to be hearing from three artists from the show, and we had a lot of fun doing this episode, so I hope you enjoy. Mushrooming, a word that describes looking for and collecting mushrooms and other interesting things. It belongs as a legitimate verb in the common language. Mushrooming can happen in the woods, in the park, in the supermarket, and many other surprising environments like the basement and the art museum. Sometimes a mushroomer finds many valuable mushrooms and has plenty of them to cook for dinner. Sometimes they only find other interesting things. That is an excerpt from Mushroom's Manifesto from the book Mushrooming, The Joy of the Quiet Hunt by artist and educator Diane Bersado. Welcome. It's so nice to have you here. And it's a pleasure to be able to sit down with you and talk about your work and celebration of your work in the Symbiosis exhibition.
Thanks so much, Jamie. It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me and including me in this amazing exhibition.
There's so much to talk about. I really would love people to explore Diane Bersado's book, Mushrooming, The Joy of the Quiet Hunt, was the inspiration that Mel Granley and I were really inspired about and brought me to look into your work a little bit more deeper. And I was really excited about the idea of making mushrooming into these beautiful posters that we commissioned you to do for the Symbiosis exhibition. Can you talk a little bit just about yourself, about your practice, and introduce us, and then we'll go into details of mushrooming.
Sure. I guess I have a pretty wide-ranging practice, and in some respects, it includes various activities that are not exactly art, but as an artist, I think I bring an artistic way of being and thinking to anything I do. So for many years, I've been collecting mushrooms, you know, mostly for the table and learning to identify them and joining, you know, clubs and mycological societies and learning about nature through mushrooms. For at least 13, 14 years, I've also been keeping bees. I learned with my dad, and it's something that I do with him and also with my son. And that's also been a very rich source of learning about nature and the environment and other beings, and contributed to my understanding of environmental art as well. I teach studio art at the University of Guelph, and my works include things like leading mushroom forays for artists and a wider public, from various cultural perspectives. And I have another project where I made an orchard, an apple orchard, as public art, you know, reimagining what public art can be and thinking about trees maybe as the best sculpture I could think of. You know, I'm really interested in food, in nature, and in performance, in living art broadly. And for me, there are very few boundaries between them all.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading your book, Mushrooming, and how you describe other artists that are working in the fields and your collaborative practice, which I really appreciated. And you also talk a little bit about the outdoor school that was before your publication, Mushrooming. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so outdoor school is broadly a name that myself and my partner, Amish Morel, have given to practices that we realized we were doing, you know, sort of adjacent to our art practice for many, many years. And so Amish is also a professor, and, he grew up in the woods in Cape Breton Island. I grew up in the suburbs, and so we have very different relationships to things in the natural world. He is a kind of very much interested in space and range and journeys and learning about history and relationships to land, where I love specimens and things I can eat or know or have certain kinds of, you know, relationships with that are quite intimate. So the two of us, sometimes we teach artists about environmental practices and expand environmental literacy. We've led a residency at the Banff Center called Outdoor School for Artists. I teach a class at the University of Guelph, when they let me, called Outdoor School for Artists, making, you know, video and performance. In that class, we work on an organic farm. We visit the apiary. We meet, you know, researchers, and I encourage these kinds of conversations across disciplines for artists to do research, deepen their literacy, and then respond as artists to, you know, an environmental crisis and to model new ways of being in the world and in relation to, you know, other beings and the places we live. So broadly, we call this work Outdoor School, and we made a publication it was a good use of pandemic years to finish this publication, including the works of many artists we've collaborated with and shown together with over the years, you know, are all part of this project, bringing different perspectives to the subject.
So reading Mushrooming, the enjoyment of reading and learning about other projects and these ideas and collaborations, you've really curated a collection of not only mushrooms, but also people and ideas and the concepts that you talk about. So I was hoping that you would be able to expand on the manifesto in the Mushrooming, the Joy of the Quiet Hunt.
I mean, essentially, I'm definitely not a scientist. And so coming into this project, I had been studying mushrooms for many years. And of course, I'm an artist and I can't really separate those two ways of thinking. So I knew that if I wanted to make a book of specimens, each, you know, sort of charismatic, marvelous, colorful, strange, eccentric beings, that I would also include examples of works by artists. And all of these things teach me and, you know, provide new models for ways of being in relationship with one another and are fascinating and help me think about ideas from, you know, sustainable building materials to taboos around death, you know, to fermenting, you know, collaborations across species. And so all these artists in the book, like Gediminas and Nomeda Urbonas or Lorraine Fournier or J. Rim Lee, you know, they really bring a lot to the conversation for me and expand my understanding of mycology and the natural world and basically everything, right? Because it's all connected. And so you were asking about the manifesto at the end specifically.
Yeah.
Oh, so I realized that, again, I'm not writing a normal field guide the way a scientist would with primary research about specimens, but instead I wanted to bring my perspective as an artist and educator and from within, you know, kind of looking out around at contemporary art to sort of frame the ideas that the mushrooms bring up for me and that have this practice of being in the woods quietly, attentively, you know, looking closely at things. They've taught me so much about connections across species, across life and death. They've taught me so much about beauty, you know, about what grows in rot and shit. I mean, about the power of very, very small things. They can never be underestimated. And so some of these kinds of lessons, things that I try and share with my students as we learn about environmental practices, I really wanted to frame them in a kind of succinct way. They kept coming up for me every time I wrote about species. And so the manifesto at the end of the book, which isn't in any other field guide as far as I know, is a way for me to frame those important ideas I've learned from mushrooming and to, yeah, share them.
I really enjoyed reading the book because it did feel different from, you know, reading a scientific book on mushrooms. You have a way of giving the mushrooms almost like a human quality, you know, in thinking about their personalities, people's experiences with the mushrooms. And in some of them, I actually burst out laughing because, you know, you were talking about a scientist that had I tasted a mushroom and woke up 24 hours later with one shoe on. So there's these amazing little, you know, anecdotes throughout the book that really bring out the appreciation of the experience of mushrooming. And I really appreciated also hearing about your collaborations. You've brought together groups of people together like astronomers and mycologists to connect the wide expanse of celestial with the subcutaneous. And I want to hear a little bit about that. And that you're, in doing that, connecting the macro and micro worlds in science with art. And I think that's also really fascinating. Can you expand on the purpose or goals of that experience and what came from sharing, you know, those experiences in those circles?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think artists really have a lot to bring to these conversations because we have different tools than scientists have, right? And so artists can bring a sense of humor and, you know, can bring personal anecdotes and can bring, you know, ways of seeing and interpreting and responding that are fanciful and poetic and, you know, moving in all kinds of different ways. I mean, I share this experience that you do that, you know, each specimen, I'm just looking at some examples on the wall, you know, they have a name. Sometimes the names are hilarious,
yeah,
and
true.
You know, poetic and evocative, like dog's vomit slime mold, or, you know, destroying angel, or bleeding tooth, or, you know, Biting Rasula, I was just reading, that you have locally. And so each one is just full of stories. And I think artists can bring that sort of cultural, you know, the history, the haiku, the recipes, the, you know, personal experiences, the hallucinations, the spiritual dimension to relating to these species. And that's a really important, you know, truths to expand what might come from the close scientific looking. And so I think you were mentioning a piece I made many years ago called Terrestrial Celestial. And actually I made it in BC. I can't imagine. I planned an event that needed clear skies in Vancouver. And fortunately it was clear, because what I wanted to do was bring together the local mycological society, who were the mushroomers, to share their terrestrial knowledge. We would look down on the ground together. And then I brought them together with the local astronomical society. And so these are the people who love to look at the stars and interpret what's happening in the cosmos. And so we spent the evening looking up for celestial knowledge. And this is an older work of mine that I still think about all the time. And I think it was a really important moment in my practice, you know, thinking about making compositions out of groups of people, creating an event, you know, sort of surprising combination of activities in an event. And also, I was thinking a lot about hierarchies. And at the time, there were a lot of social practice artists who were sort of like teaching people how much better things could be in their own way, which was great. But I didn't feel like I had enough knowledge to teach anyone anything and was more greedy to learn. And so I brought together groups of experts, and we each took turns being teachers, and we each took turns being students. And we looked at the ground and we looked at the sky. And for me, it was not just earth and sky. It was also about ways of knowing, you know, from very intimate and, a mushroom in your hand, like that decays in minutes or hours, and it's smelly and you can taste it. It's very bodily and immediate, to astronomical ways of knowing, which are super imaginative and conceptual and remote. You know, you have to imagine you're looking back in time. And so it was this huge spectrum of space and also of ways of knowing, and across, for me as an artist, you know, just to bring that together to kind of make that huge range of ways of knowing felt. And also just to practice that kind of humility and the incompleteness of all of our knowledge, and that, you know, maybe in one day we could learn everything. You know, it was like it was a hopeful but inevitably impossible project, you know, that we would do all of earth and sky. I mean, sort of playing with that, you know, dream of knowing everything, which inevitably is impossible.
I think, you know, that speaks so beautifully to just addressing the intangible and the micro and the macro and bringing those worlds together. And there's something really special about connecting two worlds together that are usually very divided. And I think that brings about this idea of interconnection and symbiotic relationships. And so much of, you know, symbiosis is talking about the importance of interconnection and mutually beneficial relationships. And I think what you do is bringing people together in these worlds and finding similarities and addressing the unknown as something really important to be humbled by.
Yeah, just a kind of curiosity practice or something. You know, we could all wonder at it all and share our knowledge and, yeah, experience it all rapturously too, because it's really wonderful to be in the woods and among colorful, sparkling, alive, fragrant, smelly, strange, surprising things.
Mysterious. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to talk about the quiet hunt, the concept of not picking, to only admire and study, and the field identification, the experience of mushrooming in the pursuit of deepening knowledge and experience beyond the forage itself. Let's talk about what it means to sharpen the senses, training the eye for keen observation and modes of sensing. I really enjoyed how you talked about that, and think about, you know, artists and mushroomers having a keen sense of observation, training your eye to look at the forest and experience the forest through all the senses.
Mm-hmm. Every year I take my studio art students mushrooming, except for this year, actually, because I'm here. But I have been explaining this for many years to my colleagues, that mushrooming teaches people to see. And if you don't mind, I can read a couple of paragraphs about what we see. So this is from the Introduction to Mushrooming. Identifying mushrooms requires a patient and rigorous sensing, especially seeing. You have to notice mushrooms amid the leaf litter and then attune your vision so acutely as to see the subtlest shifts in coloration, striation, and luminosity. A single page of an identification key asks you to see if your specimen is marbled, veined, hollow, or bruised. At extremes, a key will demand you recognize the difference between pale buff and pale to medium creamy buff. Is the stalk tapered at the apex or tapered at the base? It asks you to feel if your mushroom cap is cottony, gelatinous, grooved, or warty. Is it smooth or granular, fibrous or friable, slimy or suede-like? Does the specimen taste peppery or acrid? Is the odor like anise or library paste? The list of features you're prompted to see and feel and taste and smell goes on and on. To practice mushrooming is to develop an impressive sensory literacy, and for artists working in any media, this means almost everything. I tell the visual artists that I work with that looking for mushrooms is also an exercise in recognizing unseen worlds, something you can only do with an openness to mystery and surprise. Mushrooms are not plants and they're not animals. They make up their own entire kingdom. You practice paying attention to the small and the ephemeral. You see what others dismiss and tread upon, what is reviled and unlovely, the slimy and degraded stuff growing in compost and rot. You have to see beauty in unexpected places, aphrodisiacs and medicine and food so marvelous that people will fall off cliffs to collect it. You learn to identify otherworldly portals too in mushrooms that conjure jewels, fairies, angels, demons, and conduits to the divine. So, just some of the things you see when you're mushrooming that are visual and, you know, use all of your senses and then even into seeing other worlds, worlds that no one else sees if they're not looking for them. So it's great practice for artists.
Yeah. And I see that in your art practice. And so we're very lucky that you're in the show. And the work that you shared with us for Symbiosis with your book, Mushrooming the Joy of the Quiet Hunt, and the beautiful posters that you made for us. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's so, so fun and great to be here.
I guess I'll start by asking you to introduce yourself and maybe your work in Symbiosis.
Sarah Jim Thanasne, Chasaleat Sanet Sanich, E Husaikum, Sequemptin Thanamain, Wendy Thanatain. My name is Sarah Jim. I'm from Husanich, from the Sycam village. My dad's name is Sequemptin, or his English name is David. We're Coast Salish and Mexican. And my mom's name is Wendy. She's English and Russian Jewish. I'm a visual artist and also do environmental restoration around my home territory. And my piece in Symbiosis is a painting on a wooden round of forest plants and mushrooms, and in the center there's a little wren compiled of stars. So it's kind of a whimsical piece, and it showcases the interconnectivity of the plants to the mushrooms, but also like the earth to the sky and everything in between.
I love your work. Jamie and I were really excited to be able to work with you. And I had worked with you on a project before. You were part of, I think, the first show I ever curated for Time Immemorial. And so when we were sort of thinking about this show, I was like, oh, I gotta get Sarah in. Like, it's like a very natural choice. And so it's been really fun, like, showing people your work. And we put it at the start of the show. So it's sort of the first thing that people see when they come in. I was wondering, when and how did you become interested in plants and ecology?
When I was a little bush res kid, I would go to the beach with my sisters and we'd like play all day, and we had the forest in our backyard, and I loved nature, but I didn't understand it. I didn't ask questions. I just kind of took it for what it was and appreciated it. And when I was, this is kind of like the silly answer to this question, and I can also give like a serious one too. When I went to UVic to get an art degree after high school, and as you do when you're at UVic or at any university, you work as a server at a restaurant or whatever. And I was working at this pub and I did not like it. I did not like serving people. There was no meaning behind it. It just didn't feel good for me. And I was going to quit, but I got fired instead because I was actually really bad at this job. But it was kind of fate because I was talking to my sister who was working at that time at the tribal school as a Sinchothan immersion teacher. And I was just venting to her being like, I don't want to be a server. I want to do something meaningful. I want to be outside. I maybe want to do restoration without knowing what that was. And she was like, oh, I know this lady. Her name's Judith. And she works at the school at this garden. And I'll connect you two. And so I connected to this person. And we became really good friends in the end. And like we worked together doing environmental restoration at Papakan Hayout, which means blossoming place in Sinchothan. And it is the native plant and garden nursery at the tribal school. And so that was 5 years ago. And since then, my life took a incredible turn for the better because I found purpose doing this job. I reconnected with culture and identity and the land. And that being said, I didn't really have a significant cultural connection to being Husanich. Like I grew up on the res, but I didn't know who I was and all these kind of confusing upbringings. And so this job really gave me purpose and really helped me connect to who I am. And it is really meaningful to do restoration because it gives me a purpose that I was not getting when I was serving. So that is how I really became interested and appreciated plants more, because then I started to know who they were and I felt like they started to know who I was. And so this feeling of belonging has become more and more since beginning this job 5 years ago.
Mm, that's really beautiful. Like amazing that you could find that place to like take so much meaning from.
Yeah, it's hard to like know who I was before all of this because it's so integrated into my life now. And like I am the bummer at dinner parties where I'm like, invasive plants are bad and everyone doesn't want to hear it, but they need to. Yeah. So it's finding that balance of like approaching these issues with compassion and not trying to be condescending.
Yeah. What's the worst invasive plant? I know that's not a question.
Oh, man.
Talked about, but what's the worst one?
There's so many. This is a plant I haven't worked with, but it's kind of like broom. It's called gorse. Oh. But broom isn't spiky, but gorse is. So it's extra menacing because it's just covered in spikes. Mm-hmm. Himalayan blackberry is pretty bad because it's so aggressive and it's so normalized. Like every summer people really romanticize like, oh, I go blackberry picking every summer. And it's really good to connect to the land in that way. But really folks should understand the impacts that this plant is having on the rest of the ecosystem.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
There's like, I live in Esquimalt on the old railway track. Mm-hmm. It's just blackberry bushes.
Yeah.
Like for like so long.
Yeah. And with blackberry, it's with any invasive plant, it typically creates a monoculture. So there's just only one plant in one area. Mm-hmm. And with the blackberry, you do see bees on all the flowers and it is quite buzzing in the summertime. And yes, it's good for bees to have that food, but they also need a more diverse diet mm-hmm. too. So like people, we can't just eat like carrots all the time. We have to have other things to supplement our nutrition. And it kind of makes me think about how indigenous folks, a lot of people are like lactose intolerant because they didn't grow up with dairy.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel like those little bees' tummies might be hurting just eating blackberry flowers all the time. So yeah, we need to have diversity in the landscape to not only benefit the ecosystem and the pollinators and the animals, but also to be more resilient to climate change. Mm-hmm. Because when a landscape's more resilient to weather changing, it's has a better chance.
Yeah, I think the Gary Oak ecosystem has been like really deeply impacted by like colonization and invasive species. Mm-hmm. I think it's at like 5% of what it had been before colonization, and that's just...
Yeah, it's really bad. Luckily, like essentially we're in the UN decade of ecosystem restoration, whatever that means, but the UN declared this, and so hopefully this is inspiring people to do more restoration, because mm-hmm. that's essentially what's gonna help us. Yeah. Is looking at the land and asking it what it needs.
Yeah. I was wondering about your piece Stars and Spores. What were your inspirations for the piece, and can you speak a little bit about the flora that you represented in the painting?
So my line of work is more catered towards plants, and my knowledge is typically like native plant knowledge, cultural, and I don't know much about mushrooms, and so this opportunity actually really was exciting for me because I got to kind of dive deep and do some research about mushrooms, and all this research is coming out about mycelium being the connections that forests need to survive, and that's a really beautiful lesson that we could all learn from, because essentially the only way we can move forward is if community is connected and if we support each other. And so I had thoughts of that, and I started a restoration project in my home village, Sycam, on my like family's property. And it's a forest with, you know, sword ferns, native blackberries. There's mushrooms all over it. And so just spending time in that forest was really inspiring. There's trilliums in there. So I've been mushroom picking for chanterelles, and that's the only one I can really identify because it's pretty obvious. But I just think I really just wanted to showcase the plants and the mushrooms being friends, mm-hmm. because that's how I see them. That's how I see plants, is as my friends and relatives and entities that I can co-regulate with. And this might be into your next question, but the little wren in the center, all of these things I've seen in my forest, mostly other than some of the mushrooms. Mm-hmm. But I've seen the little wren, and it's so cute, and it's like really round and has like the cute little tail. And it's so small and so underlooked that I really wanted to showcase it in my art, because a lot of Coast Salish art depicts the charismatic megafauna, like orcas, wolves, bears, things like this, which have a place and they have stories and lessons they can teach us. But I really wanted to highlight the little creatures and the kind of weirder ones. In my art, I like to show like slugs and frogs and the kind of like outcasts and underdogs, just because they don't get that spotlight. And same with the plants too. Like, not a lot of Coast Salish art traditionally had plants shown in it. And art is a really valuable way to start dialogue about the land, about restoration, about why this is important. And it really situates the land in context to like indigenous people. And so I think plants are beautiful and they deserve to be seen. And this is a way, art is a way for plants to be seen as individuals instead of in the forest. Like, people who don't really know about plants just see green.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll see ivy and be like, this is beautiful. Like, look at it grow up the tree, and not have that understanding of like what they're actually looking at. Yeah. And so art for me is a way to utilize people's attention. Like, now that I have your attention, I'm going to talk to you about why it matters.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I had a moment over the summer where I was on a walk in a forest, and I just had this moment where I was like really paying attention to the differences of the plants I was seeing and like the different leaves, and like how when you're actually looking, there's so many different things around you. It's not just a bunch of leaves of the same plant. There were so many different things, and I was just like, whoa, oh my gosh, that's different from that, and that's different from that. I've never noticed that before, and I didn't know where they all came from, but it made me really interested in like learning more, mm-hmm. and like knowing what here has always been here and what am I seeing that is newer and mm-hmm. is sort of taking over. And with the show, I think your work was really important, because I know, like, while we were, like, corresponding, you're like, I don't know that much about mushrooms. And I was like, that's okay, because Jamie and I really wanted to highlight the importance of, like, the entire forest. And I think sometimes people can sort of focus on the mushrooms because they're, like, really weird and, like, colorful and, like, there's so much new information coming out about them. But the show is, like, equally about, like, forest ecologies and trees and plants as it is about mushrooms. And so I think that's sort of a piece that gets left out within the mushroom and mycelium conversation.
Yeah, I really appreciate the wanting to highlight the whole ecosystem, because they don't exist in isolation. Like, there's so many parallels to societal community and culture. Like, we could learn so much from the forest if we just approached it with that empathy of seeing, like, oh, there's this plant is serrated, this plant is smooth, this plant is lobe. Like, we're all individuals, but we all live in the same place and need to work together.
Yeah, I think I care a lot about, like, indigenous knowledge and science coming together and, like, converging, and like origin stories and, like, ideas of spirit being reflected in, like, how people approach science and, like, how they approach knowledge about the land. Yeah, I just saw a documentary called Fungi Web of Life, and it was depicting, like, mycelium, like, underneath the ground and, like, connecting everything. And I was just thinking about, like, spirit and how, like, everything is connected through that, and, like, indigenous people know that spirit exists and that everything is connected in that way and that things communicate with each other. And, like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's really beautiful and overwhelming.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think the only way we can really move forward in this era of climate change is if indigenous knowledge and science work together. And I love when, like, science and indigenous knowledge meet, because there's so many instances of scientists, like, being perplexed about something, and then indigenous people are like, yeah, we've known that for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And one of the examples is, so we have the origin story of the Great Flood, and many cultures do around here. Essentially, there was a Great Flood 10,000 years ago, and it was because people started living outside of the laws of the land, like taking too much and not giving back. And it was a lesson that Hales, the creator, had gifted to the people, but the people forgot and they started not listening. And so the creator punished them, like threatened them with the flood, and then a flood came eventually, and the people who didn't believe in it drowned. And the people who did believe it had their canoes, they had giant cedar ropes, and they had all these supplies. And once the flood came, the waters rose and the people got in their canoes. And the last bit of land that they saw was this mountain on the peninsula called Tleilnoch. And so they paddled over there and tied their ropes to an arbutus tree and, like, waited out the flood. It kind of reminds me of, like, when you're a kid and you're, like, on timeout. So they were there for how many days, and this raven Squatah, like, landed on one of their canoes and had a stick in its mouth. And so the people are like, this is a sign there's land around, like the waters must be going down. And so eventually the waters did start to recede, and the Saanich Peninsula was what emerged. And that's what the people said. They said in Sinchothan, Nekwenit the Saanich, which means, like, look what's emerging. And so the people were like, okay, this is where we're going to call home now, and we are going to be Saanich, the emerging people, and this is the Saanich, the territory. Little side note, it's interesting that Saanich, the place, and Saanich, the people, are the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no different words for that, it's the same. So it just goes to show, like, the people are the land. But anyway, the story ends with the people in Saanich, the emerging people, and this story happened 10,000 years ago and has been told orally since then, which is amazing. And scientists have had approached our people and were like, hey, did you know there was a flood here 10,000 years ago? And we're like, yeah, we teach our children that. Like, I knew that. Like, that was one of the first stories I heard. But scientists have gone to different places around the territory and have, like, carbon dated or did sediment testing and, like, prove that that actually happened. And so it's just, like, amazing when those instances can, like, they don't need to be proved to be validated, but it's just interesting that science is, like, finally catching up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's just one totally off topic instance.
No, I think it's super on topic. I think it's amazing. I had also heard an example of that. Anishinaabe people, there's a story of squirrels teaching people how to get maple syrup from trees. And that's one of their like origin stories. That's one of their stories that they teach each other. And scientists were like, oh, that can't be real. They just must have learned it somehow. But recently they observed squirrels tapping trees and like accessing that. And it really like, I guess, validated for the scientific community that like indigenous knowledge is not like based on nothing. It's very, very like, yeah, real. And
it is science. It's observing. It's observational. And
yeah, it's also like the lack of validation to like oral histories is really like a problem. And I think people need to pay attention more to like how powerful oral histories are and how amazing it is as like a knowledge transferal. Like, we actually don't need like to write huge texts for our knowledge to be transferred. It just like has this like way of going from person to person and generation to generation. Like,
yeah. And that's a really good point, because with this flood story that I just told, it's so transferable to today. In, I keep saying this era of climate change, but like we have ice caps melting and the sea is rising. And this is because people stopped living within the laws of the land. Like, we are extracting too much and polluting the earth. And this ancient story is so applicable to right now.
We only have a few minutes left, so I guess my last question, would you care to talk a little bit about your relationship to the forest and the land? I feel like you have touched on it, but if you have anything that you'd like to say on that, kind of a big question to end with.
Yeah. I find that being in nature, and you know, science will tell this because certain chemicals get emitted from trees and affect your brain in a positive way. Being in nature is really helpful for me. It's a way for me to like co-regulate with the plants and the trees and everything. And I just find it really powerful that I can, as a career, I can be out in nature helping it and advocating for it and sharing how to do it with others. But I also volunteer my time as well to like do that restoration project in Sycam that I was talking about, taking out ivy. So my relationship is, I feel like it's reciprocal. I don't often harvest, but I would feel okay harvesting because I'm doing this like invasive removal work. Mm-hmm. I think it's problematic when people just go out into the forest and take and don't give back. Because that's not a relationship. That's like a one-sided interaction. So I have a very intimate connection with like the forest and plants and things. I know very little. Like, I'm still learning every single day. But learning has given me more of a appreciation for this place.
I was interested in hearing about the term that you mentioned at the artist talk about decolonizing the land and pulling invasive species. And yeah, I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that and what knowledge you have on the impact of these species on the native flora and ecology of the island.
There's so many parallels of invasive plants and like settler culture and colonization. So essentially, before colonization, like 200 years ago here on the West Coast, there was nothing but indigenous people stewarding the land and growing this intimate relationship with place. And then when settlers came here, they had this fallacy of like an untouched wilderness. But this is not right, because indigenous people actually had like incredible technology to maintain food systems, like burning the camas meadows and multiple different examples. But so once these like settlers came and kind of disrupted that relationship to place and land, what followed them was invasive plants. And some were planted intentionally, like Scotch broom was planted because this Scottish guy's wife was like, oh, you're going to the new world, here's some seeds and to remind you of home. And Scotch broom is like a terrible invasive plant. There was no foresight of what that plant could have had on this landscape. But anyway, so invasive plants have slowly taken over and slowly creep their way into these ecosystems. And the reason they're invasive is because they're very aggressive and they invade and they don't care about anything else. They're just trying to like benefit themselves. So there's a lot of places around, probably all over the world, that are just full of, let's say, English ivy, like the forest that I'm stewarding. Everything's English ivy. It's like growing up the trees. It takes down fully grown trees because it's trying to reach for the light, and it's just really aggressive and it strangles. And it's not its fault that it's there, but it doesn't belong there in such an aggressive manner. And so what I mean by when I say decolonizing the land is removing this these invasive plants, removing the ivy so the trees can breathe and so the native plants have a chance. Because when there's a carpet of ivy on the forest floor, the native foods and medicines don't have any room to grow. They don't have access to light. And this is really metaphorical and symbolic and poetic of how settlers can conduct themselves on Indigenous land. The first thing we have to do is like educate ourselves. So like, why is this ivy problematic and what can we do about it? And the second thing is actually taking action and removing it in a respectful way and not like hating the ivy, but realizing like, let's learn together and let's remove it in like a nice way. And it's really beautiful to see what comes up after the ivy is removed. Like all of these native seeds have just been in the soil waiting to take their moment. And once they do, it's slow at first, but then really these native ecosystems can bounce back. They're like really resilient. And I feel that this is really applicable to people as well. So like when Indigenous people have the chance to speak and a chance to take up space, they can really thrive. And so, yeah, decolonizing the land just to me is a really feasible and tangible way of decolonization, because that's such a huge term. Like, what does it actually mean? Mm-hmm. And so this is my way of giving access to folks who have asked me questions like, how do I be an ally? Like, how do I serve the Indigenous communities for the better? And usually that's what I suggest is like, start by taking out your lawn and planting a native meadow, or like removing the blackberry around your house and see what comes up. And so this is a really good way to start, is with the land, because I mentioned earlier, like Saanich, the people in Saanich, the land, are one. Like, we have such an intimate tie with this place. Like, our language comes from the land, our art comes from the land. And so creating access to these natural native ecosystems not only benefits the pollinators and animals and everything, but also benefits the people, because the people need these like foods and medicines to be able to carry on the culture.
Yeah, I really like the comparison between plants and invasive plants with settlers. During my research for symbiosis, I came across an article that was examining this death cap that had come over from Europe and is now like populated on the island in excess. And that felt like a really physical, tangible moment of colonization, that there's this poisonous mushroom that will kill you if you eat it, that is just here now because of coming over on a boat.
Yeah, it's all about education and like really, like I said earlier, approaching people with empathy, being like, it's okay that you didn't grow up with this knowledge. Like, I didn't grow up with this knowledge. We're all learning together. But that brings me to one point of, so there's like invasive plants like ivy and broom and blackberry. And then there's exotic plants like rhododendrons and apple trees. Mm-hmm. And what we at Papakenhao like to advocate is like, you could either be ivy, which is problematic and invasive, and I don't like to use the words good and bad, but it's pretty bad. And there's like an apple tree, which kind of just takes up its own space, and it actually provides nourishment, like apples and blossoms and everything. And it deserves to take up its own space, but it's not trying to spread and take up too much space. So there's just ways that the land can teach us things. Like, even if you are a settler in these territories, like, you could be an apple tree.
That's I love that.
And you could even go a little bit deeper in being like, apple trees thrive when they're pruned and taken care of, and there's like self-care and all these things. So yeah, there's a lot that we can learn from plants.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I think that's a really good spot to end.
Yeah. Hi, Chika.
So welcome, Randy. We're speaking with Randy Cook, one of the many amazing artists in the Symbiosis exhibition. We're really happy to have you here today. And I just want to know if you can talk a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Thank you. Gila Kasla. Nugwa am makula. Gehin lacha mam tegila glu namgis. Kwakwa kiwauk. In English, my name is Randy Cook. I am Kwakwa kiwauk. I'm from many tribes within the Kwakwa kiwauk, but I hold a chieftainship that is from the mam tegila. My traditional name is Makula. And a lot of the work that I do actually begins with my origin stories, you know, going back to creation time and how these positions came to be and what it means to be a chief. So for me, even being an artist, it really is reflecting on the land that I come from, you know, thinking about my history, but really the origin stories that we drew from. And it was really more about the origin stories in relationship to the significance of land, you know, to Mother Earth, and how our environment had informed us from our very beginnings.
That's amazing. And you can really see that in all of the work that you do and the way that you work with community. And I find it to be, you know, overlapping and interdisciplinary in your practices and what I see you doing as both an artist and commitment to the preservation of old growth forests and also the preservation of community through that work. Could you talk a little bit about the foundation?
Yeah, it's called the Awitna Kiola Foundation. Awitna Kiola essentially means environment. Means more than that. I mean, our language is a lot more descriptive, but it's essentially relates to all living things from the air, land, ocean. And it is really nice to actually hear our elders at home speak about it, because they'll say, Maya Hila Hins Awitna Kiola, respect all living things. And it's not really like the word just respect, it's really about a way of life. So the foundation has really been informed by that, by our elders. So it's the braiding of our indigenous knowledge and art and science, all coming together and finding solutions and ways of actually protecting and preserving what is left, but really how we can think about restorative projects moving forward. I often say it's like we can romanticize about our past as indigenous people. We can romanticize about our practice on the land, who we are, what informed us, but we have to acknowledge the impacts of colonization and how colonization has also informed us today. Even our cultures, you know, we've been so heavily colonized, we have to decolonize our own cultures even as Indigenous people. So for me, I keep looking at that and asking questions, what does that mean? And then for me, it's going back to the origin stories of what our first ancestors laid down for us. What was the foundation of that time? And really, it was just about respecting Mother Earth, because that's what nourished us. And that's why our philosophy was always to leave everything standing and living, such as trees and plants and so on. So the cultivation, the practices, were always about taking what we only needed, you know, and contributing to the longevity of these ecosystems that helped us to sustain and thrive and, you know, to be and live as we did. But I keep thinking, like, today, though, in this current time, it's not like that. You know, we are coming to the land now and seeing it completely decimated. You know, we are in a time where, you know, the government is talking about truth and reconciliation, but in truth and reconciliation, there is no acknowledgement of land. So there is no real reconciliation until we can reconcile with the amount of damage we've done to Mother Earth. And that goes back to our practices. We've always respected Mother Earth because Mother Earth provided for us. But we are in a time now where the government doesn't want to acknowledge the land still and Mother Earth, because there's still resource extraction feeding into capital values. And that's what's driving a wedge between, you know, governments, corporations, and us as Indigenous people. So there isn't any reconciliation in that until we start to talk about that. So for myself, I look at that and I hang on to that heavily in my daily practice as being a chief. So taking that into consideration and developing and designing the Awit Nakula Foundation is really about, you know, how do we bring in people who want to share in these values that we have carried for a long time as Indigenous people. So today, thinking about Canada, you know, instead of separating us as Indigenous peoples from the rest of Canada and non-Indigenous people, we can be inviting non-Indigenous people in to share in these values. And if we can start educating and sharing in that, then we can start to create a better environment and stronger allyship, and we can work towards healthier ecosystems. Therefore, it really does just paint that black and white picture where it really is about government and power still in corporations. And that's global, you know, it's not just a Canadian issue, it's global. So for the Awit Nakula Foundation, we want to expand beyond our own borders to work with other Indigenous groups also towards healing land projects.
It's amazing. So in terms of access of solidarity, think about the UNDRIP and how that is an access of solidarity of Indigenous people and the rights of Indigenous peoples. And it's so important to think about that in terms of forming a critical mass of support and the need and necessity to change perspectives, to shift perspectives with a more Indigenous worldview. I think that's so important, you know, when you think about like the preservation, the restoration, the regeneration, and environmental justice. I think that it's so critical right now because you talk about the remaining 2.7 old growth forests in BC and their regenerative projects that you're working on with the foundation. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, one or two of the projects that you're working towards?
Mm-hmm. It was a couple of years ago now where it was calculated that there's 2.7% left of old growth in all of BC. But what hasn't been spoken of since then is the 40% increase in deforestation, not the other way around. So for us to meet a target such as 2030, to even say like no more logging kind of thing, is ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, it's so far away from where we are just in the past, you know, with 2.7% left, but a 40% increase in just a short amount of time really shows where we're at. And I think that's the scary part. So we look at that through the Awit Nakula Foundation and we think about, you know, what is happening on the land. For me, I mean, I love being on the land because it informs me in so many different ways, but it just helps me to speak even politically to our government. And just even thinking about like yesterday, there was an agreement that just came to be between a group within the Kwakwaka'wakw called the Nunmakolas Foundation, which is four tribes out of the Kwakwaka'wakw. When there's 16 tribes within the Kwakwaka'wakw, there's only four within Nunmakolas. They signed a $39 million agreement with Western Forest Products and the province in forestry. So those four nations within the Kwakwaka'wakw are speaking for all 16 tribes. And that goes against meeting targets such as 2030. So, you know, sitting and listening to that being delivered of the legislator and thinking about our current climate and where we're at really puts things in perspective around how much more work that we actually need to be doing. So when we think about regenerative projects, which is led by the Mother Tree Network, you know, in partnership with Suzanne Simard and her team, you know, there's a series of different kinds of sampling that they do, you know, from soil sampling and collecting, you know, data around carbon, but also regenerative, where we're thinking about plantations and opening up canopies so that can stimulate the floor ground. The seeds are there. The soil just needs to be turned. But it's also about just getting youth on the land. So this past summer, we created, you know, an opportunity for community to get out on the land to just share in conversation. Most of the work that I really believe in, though, is getting our people back on the land. First and foremost, I mean, that's the most important part, is our people need to get off the reserve lands and recognize that our traditional lands are far greater and it's all of ours. And what informs these relationships for the past thousands of years is like running into a culturally modified tree. You know, by simply seeing a culturally modified tree and doing a core sample and recognizing that the bark had been harvested 700 years ago proves that there's a relationship there. And that relationship contributed to rituals, ceremonies, regalia, everything, you know, like those are so important. So I try and start there. But before we can do anything such as a regenerative project with scientists, they need to be welcomed by us as Indigenous people. They can't be racing onto the land, because we need to be there to welcome, you know, I think people from all backgrounds who are doing any kind of work, because it's the healing that needs to happen. It's, you know, it's the information that needs to be ignited. But I think more importantly, like I can't say enough about getting our people on the land just to heal us from the impacts of residential school, the impacts of colonization, you know, why reserves were created. All of these things were created to get us off the land for resource extraction, and that's what's still happening. You know, government hasn't changed, and that's why I say there's no reconciliation when it comes to government. We have to get our people on the land. So I'm just trying to create opportunities for youth, really young kids right now, actually, to go as simply as just berry picking programs. You know, going and getting to know the land so they can speak to it. And even their simple pruning projects, you know, things like that. Pulling bark on smaller trees and doing weaving, you know, workshops.
That's so important. And I think what you said about how colonialism, you know, through tactics like the residential school system in Canada, took people away from the language and took people away from the land. And so your foundation's work around bringing kids to the land and reconnecting with that relationship is so vital. We think about, you know, kids knowing more of the brands of clothing more than knowing what kinds of trees are in their forest, in their backyard. So the reconnection to the land and thinking about the restorative justice on the land can only be done if we understand it and we have a connection to it. And I really, you know, enjoyed the work that you had in the show and that you made for us in Symbiosis Exhibition. Can you talk a little bit about the GMO prints that you made and the plant vibration masks that you made in the show and how it relates to the work that you do with the foundation?
Yeah, I'll start with the masks, actually, because they're quite unique. It goes back to, and it's a bit of a story.
Yeah, love stories.
So when we would begin our Dzeka rituals, and Dzeka is our winter ceremonies, we would send our new initiates into the forest. And it's usually like around puberty time for boys, well, and girls too. And we have different societies within our culture. And each society looks after its own. So I'm a part of the Hamatsa society. And the Hamatsa is specifically the eldest child within a family who's going to be groomed one day to become a chief. You have to become a Hamatsa first. So you have to go through this ritual, and you go out into the forest and you have other Hamatsas that look after you. And there's old stories that I would hear around these rituals, because you would have to go and find a great cedar tree to connect with. And as you're in the forest, you're fasting, you're bathing, and you're meditating. And sometimes you could be out there for, like, I heard historically, like it could be a couple months, you know, for young boys all by themselves. And it's really about detachment. So as you're fasting, you know, you're cleansing your body and then you're going to the river and you're bathing as the sun is coming up first thing in the morning. And the reason you're doing that is because you're washing everything away from yesterday. You're trying to get rid of all of the negative thoughts and energy that consume you to make sure that you're thinking only towards the betterment of your people and yourself. So you want to be as healthy as you possibly can. And then in between that time, you're meditating. And while you're meditating, you can strive for higher consciousness. So after a certain amount of time, you'll pull the bark from the tree. And before you pull the bark, you put your head on the tree, like your forehead, and you breathe into the tree and you say, you know, I will breathe life into you as you breathe life into me. And there's an exchange. And what you're doing is you're forming a relationship with that tree, and that tree will be yours for the rest of your life. So at any given moment, if you're feeling imbalanced, you can go back to that tree and you can start to meditate and you can bathe and cleanse and recenter and rebalance. So I call it like a restart. So we've got a restart button in our culture to pull us away from all of the things that are consuming and don't serve our higher power. So it's really about that detachment process. And in doing that, it's really quite significant because I started going and I started thinking about songs that came from these rituals and masks and museums that came from these rituals and all of the information that they carry. So when you go into museums, I'm like, these masks actually come from somewhere and there's information behind them, but they've been severed. The information has been severed. And we view these objects as objects now. And they're just for, you know, their aesthetic value. But really it was because somebody went and connected and felt the vibration of that tree, felt the vibration from the land and the plants. And through higher consciousness and meditation, they were able to tap into the language of the plants where they were constantly, you know, in communication, where medicinal plants were advising people, you know, whether they were going into medicine or whether they were, you know, healers in some sort of way, or if they're warriors. So each society was directed in that way by each tree society. So tree societies inform plant species and so on. So we were putting our people into those same societies to groom them. So they were being groomed by nature in that way. And a lot of the songs talk about flying around the world. And now we're starting to realize that through that higher state, we can also reach astral projection. So people are actually leaving the physical and being able to see the world in a really unique way. And it was informing them. So it would come back and it informed us how to be better leaders, how to be better healers, and so on. So I found that like really significant. So I started to think about masks, because we're a mask culture as Kwakwaka'wakw. How can I like resurrect a mask that will carry the information? So I started to go out into the forest and I started to think about like, you know, like biowaves and technology where you can connect to different plant species and listen to sounds. And I thought that was cool because there's a communication that can happen. And, you know, it's like stroking leaves and you can hear the sound waves like going up and down. You pour water around it, you can hear the sounds change. And I thought, that's neat, but how do I harness that? So I started to like experiment in my studio and I started working with eco-epoxy because I was trying to think of other materials and I was trying to think organically, but it wasn't holding as I wanted. So I thought, okay, I'll use eco-epoxy. And then I created a mold from a wooden mask that I carved. And then I put the mold on these sensors and I started to channel the vibrations through into the mold. So as I was pouring epoxy, I was dropping colors and the vibrations started to create patterns in these masks. So when they cured, I pulled them out and I was like, all of these patterns in this mask were actually made by this plant. So I went out and I started creating a whole series of different masks based on different plant species and different trees. So for me, that was a way of gifting it back to new initiates and saying, you know, we can be an evolving culture. We can be a living culture. And if we're going to go back and really tap into the true philosophy of who we are as Kwakwaka'wakw people, that means we leave everything living. You know, it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution and the introduction of modern technology where we started to cut down the full tree and carving them into totems and building bigger houses and so on. Prior to that, we didn't cut the tree down at all. We pulled planks from the tree and left it standing in order to build our houses. We notched out blocks to carve masks. And we used the bark, you know, strategically to make ceremonial regalia and so on. But really, it was about the spirit of that tree that we knew to harm it would never be able to contribute and give back. That would be the end of its life. So we did that with everything, with our rivers, with our salmon, you know, with like our berries and our harvesting and medicinal plants. It was all in that line. So I wanted to create a series of masks that would show that historical relationship, but also just show it in a very contemporary way to also inspire artists to think, we don't have to, in this given time, in this crisis where we're trying to look, you know, look after the 2.7% left of trees, you know, if it is a crisis, then how can we contribute to the to industry by still buying our own materials and still carving them up like crazy and on and on? Maybe we can start to be creative and be the art, like artists as our ancestors were, and think about new materials.
And I think through that work, you really captured the spirit and a certain energy that provides a bit of a haunting experience when you're looking at the masks. And it is so complex hearing you talk about your process and the background of how and why you developed these masks. And for those of you who are listening, it's really hard to try to describe it visually, but they are also right next to what is called the cookie from Fairy Creek. It's a very large Douglas fir slice of a tree that has been traveling across Canada for the people on the ground, the land defenders and protectors in Fairy Creek. So there is so much power in that kind of relation that you're sharing with us through your work, but also in people experiencing seeing a slice of a tree of an old growth forest. So that relationship is really profound, and your work as well. So I really thank you for sharing and making new work for the Symbiosis exhibition. We're really lucky to have you as one of the artists in the show. I wanted to share an excerpt from Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest from Suzanne Simard, one of the people that you work with in the foundation. She says, "This is not a book about how we can save the trees. This is a book about how the trees might save us." And also, in addition to that, Robin Kiminer has talked about the land is medicine to us, but we're also medicine to the land. And I think that's so important with the work that you're doing, both as an artist, as a chief, and land protector. So I really thank you for your work.
We'd like to take a moment to thank some of our sponsors that make programs and podcasts like this possible. The Government of British Columbia, BC Arts Council, Canada Council for the Arts, Capital Regional District, and First Peoples Cultural Council. We'd also like to let you know about some free days that you can come to the gallery. TD Bank has supported some programs and days where people can come to the gallery for free. So every Thursday evening between 5 p.m. and 9 p.m., the gallery has free admission. And the first Saturday of every month is free for visitors to come visit the gallery. So thank you, TD Bank. And we'd also like to mention our studio classes. Every season we have a host of different amazing studio instructors. So please check out our website, aggv.ca, and look under the Learn tab for more information.
It's a good way to start.
Right? It might just be, you know, 20 minutes of laughing.
That's okay too.
Let's talk about mushrooms.
Are you on mushrooms right now?
I may or may not be on some tea.
Before the podcast, Randy and I had a kettle of tea. We should have, but I don't think we need it.
Oh, God. Okay.
It's a good way to start. Okay.